It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later on the show, we'll hear from a guest who makes the case that it's okay to fail, and we should be failing fast and failing often in order to perfect our ideas. First, tens of thousands of young people are in limbo at the border between U.S. and Mexico, caught trying to cross the border into the United States. Most aren't from Mexico, but are coming up from further south, from Central America, with the largest number coming from Honduras. The influx of young people has driven a response from the White House and the State Department and protests on the border in California. But why are they taking this dangerous trek north with an uncertain reception here in the U.S.? Dana Frank has studied and written about Honduras for years. She's a professor of history at the University of California, Santa Cruz. Dana, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks a lot, and thanks for having me.
So before we get into the history, what are things like in Honduras? What are the conditions that are driving thousands of young Hondurans to flee north?
Well, most of the media has been talking about this as they're fleeing gangs and violence. And they are, in fact, fleeing really dangerous gangs and spectacular violence, including violence against children. But what's been missing from the media coverage is that the Honduran government itself is largely responsible much of that violence and the proliferation of gangs. People may remember the coup 5 years ago on June 28th. They're at the fifth anniversary now. And that military coup, of which the current president was a prominent supporter, unleashed the doors of violence and criminality in Honduras. And it's been widely documented that since the murder rate is now the highest in the world, the prosecutors and judges are corrupt, and most definitely the police. The government itself has said that 70% of the Honduran police are beyond saving. That means they're involved in extortion, in bribery with gangs, and above all with drug trafficking. And that's where a lot of this criminality is coming from, that's leading to spectacular violence, because you can kill anybody you want pretty much and get away with that, and that's including killing of children. And there's no political will at the top of the Honduran government to clean it up. In fact, the answer of the Honduran government has been militarization, and including the creation of very dangerous military police that has already committed very serious human rights abuses. Just to get an example of how out of control things are, the most prominent advocate for children in Honduras is a man named Jose Guadalupe Ruelas, and he's the director of a faith-based organization, a Christian organization called Casa Alianza, and they advocate for homeless children. And about a month and a half ago, he very prominently criticized the government and said it was partly responsible for the recent massacres of children and the dangerous situation for children. And a couple days later, he was beaten up by the new military police, and a smear campaign was launched at him in the papers that are pro-government newspapers. So we're talking about a very terrifying situation.
And as you say, you see the coup in Honduras back in 2009 as a turning point. Remind us, give us a nutshell, what happened 5 years ago?
Well, the democratically elected president of Honduras, Manuel Zelaya, was placed on a plane, very famously, by the military and was sent off to Costa Rica. And with the full support of the Honduran Supreme Court, which had been handpicked a couple of few months before to support it, and most of the Honduran Congress. So it was a really overwhelming reaction by the Honduran oligarchs who control the country against somebody who was sort of pinned as a leftist, but actually was sort of slightly leaning leftward and stopping some of the power grabs that have happened ever since. And then after that, the U.S. treated Micheletti, the post-coup dictator, as an equal to Zelaya, and then recognized the outcome of a completely illegitimate election that fall of Porfirio Lobo, and that election had been boycotted by almost all the opposition and almost all international observers.
The accusations from the people behind the coup and from some in the international community were that the previous president had, in effect, been trying to organize a constitutional coup to change the Constitution, extend his term limits. What did you make of that at the time?
Oh, that was really invented out of whole cloth. He did, in fact, had the day of the coup was a public opinion poll. The president has a right in the Honduran law to have a public opinion poll, and it was taking place the day of the coup. But that was really only whether people wanted to elect delegates to constitutional convention, which would have happened a year or two later when he was well out of office. He never mentioned having a second term. That was made up by the Honduran right out of whole cloth. And in fact, the current president, Juan Orlando Hernandez, who was a big supporter of the coup at the time, has been exploring whether he could have a second term. So, which shows you, and the Micheletti, the dictator, had promoted it in the 1980s. So really, it was about pushback against some very mild things that Zelaya had been doing, including blocking privatizations that are now going forward.
You mentioned government of Honduras being responsible for the breakdown of law and order. How, and you've touched on this briefly, what have they done as far as human rights are concerned?
Well, there's been tremendous repression by the military and the police with almost complete impunity. At least 300 people are alleged to have been killed by state security forces just in the first 2 years after the coup, I think. The exact dates are complicated, but, you know, and these are almost all in complete impunity, as Human Rights Watch has pointed out, as Amnesty International has pointed out. You know, even the United States government, which has largely supported the post-coup government, very enthusiastically admits that there's widespread corruption in the criminal justice system.
And talk some more about the American response from the coup to this day. Has there been criticism of the government that came into power?
Very little. In fact, there's been a tremendous amount of enthusiastic support for it. Up to even a month ago, the ambassador to the U.S., in response to some congressional criticism we can talk about, praised Juan Orlando Hernandez's human rights commitment to human rights, you know, right after the military police beat up and tear gassed 36 members of the opposition party inside the main hall of Congress on May 13th. The U.S. has very overtly supported the successive post-coup regimes. And in the name of fighting the drug war, in fact, U.S. military and police funding for Honduras has gone, was suspended partially and briefly after the coup and has gone up every year since, along with U.S. direct military funding for its own work in Honduras. So we're talking about a very terrifying support, an overt support for a very scary regime that's waging a war against its own people and viciously attacks human rights defenders from Honduras when they have spoken in Congress, and that's led to death threats.
What would you like to see from the U.S. if you could get a reversal of current policy?
Well, first of all, we can't talk about the border children issue as something that's just happening at the border. Obviously, we need to protect the children and unite them with their families. But we can't keep pouring money into these corrupt police and military, including in the name of helping them. You know, maybe somewhere around $300 million has been poured into from various sources, including the European Union, has poured into supposedly reforming and helping train the Honduran police since the coup with almost no effect. In fact, they've been documented by the Associated Press for killing people in so-called social cleansing killings in the last year. So I think we have to immediately cut all police and military aid. We have to stop acting like they're a friendly partner. We have to stop acting like Juan Orlando Hernandez, the president, is committed to human rights and has the political will. He has been widely alleged to himself be connected to drug trafficking and clearly does not have the political will. In fact, he has this political will to actually militarize the situation, and a further militarization of any of these borders is not the answer. And I do want to underscore that 108 members of Congress at the end of May signed a letter questioning U.S. support for this regime and raising concerns about human rights. You know, at the broad level, we have to take on the drug war. I mean, the drug war is the framework in which we're pouring money into this vicious regime in Honduras. And we have to talk about prevention and addiction programs at the U.S. and stop militarizing the drug war, because that's what's pouring in the kind of support for these state security forces that are committing vast violence in Honduras and which the kids are fleeing.
So ultimately, you think we are, at least in part, we, the United States, in part responsible for the arrival of over 13,000 Honduran
youth? Absolutely. And of course, this is a long story. In Mexico, why do people leave these countries? Because of U.S., in part, because of U.S. intervention in their economies, including, you know, you can see this, certainly there's documented that the North American Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA, has caused increased migration from, or ongoing migration from Mexico, because all sorts of economic approaches are no longer viable, like growing pigs or small corn plots. And the same thing's going on in Honduras. It's the Central American Free Trade Agreement forces small producers in agriculture and manufacturing in Honduras to compete with the U.S. market. And U.S. supports policies like the International Monetary Fund, which is supporting the destruction of public sector jobs in Honduras. In fact, just a couple weeks ago, there was a meeting of the statement from the executive board of the International Monetary Fund about Honduras saying one of the things they're going to help them do is lower the government's wage bill. Well, that means cutting wages and laying off government workers, which is exactly what's happening as we speak.
It sounds like you're not optimistic about at least the near-term
future.
Well,
you know, I'm optimistic. optimistic about the fact that the congressional voice is getting stronger and stronger. I mean, a year ago, 21 senators signed a letter challenging Kerry on support for the police and military in Honduras who's committing human rights abuses, and 108 members of Congress is a lot. There were some signs of hope at the confirmation hearing for the new ambassador about 3 weeks ago, and Senator Kaine, a very important senator, new senator from Virginia, he said out loud that it was worse in Honduras than in the 1980s when he was living down there. So I actually have great hope for things, the way things are going on Congress. There's some Republican interest in this issue. There has been for a while, as well as Democrats. The problem is the State Department going to pay attention, and the White House? I mean, the White House's response, and when Biden was going down there, is to give $18.5 million more money to Honduras right as Congress has been challenging this. So the answer isn't to pour even more money into this corrupt regime, but to really shrink the whole policy in the region, and not just Honduras, but support for Perez Molina, who is, you know, documented to have been part of a genocidal regime in the 1980s. And, you know, and also talk about alternatives. I mean, why are kids not fleeing Nicaragua? No one's talking about that. It's not, they're equally a candidate for being on the route for drug traffickers, but they don't have a problem with cartels for the most part. They don't have a gang problem for the most part, and they have community-based policing. And so also to talk about, you know, why, where are the countries that aren't sending kids, along with Costa Rica? And also, let's look at El Salvador, where the murder rate has, in fact, dropped it since 2010 when the left government came in, and the current government has a really serious commitment to fighting the gang problem and to fighting poverty, and we want to respect that. So we can't glom all these countries together. That's another thing to pay attention to.
Dana, thank you so much for joining us today.
Okay, and thanks so much for caring about the issue.
That's Dana Franks. She's a professor of history at the University of California, Santa Cruz. Our next guest wants you to rethink the idea of failure. He says that from an early age, we're told to be cautious, think before acting, plan for the future, and avoid failure at all costs. But he says those ideas aren't all they're cracked up to be. If you want to succeed in your career and your life, you have to fail, and you have to do it often. Some of the most successful people in the world spend less time planning, more time doing. Let's take a look back at an interview we did with Ryan Babineau. He's a career counselor and co-author of the book, Fail Fast, Fail Often, How Losing Can Help You Win. Ryan, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Will you tell a story in your book about a ceramics class that really illustrates the point? Can you tell us that story, please?
Yes. The story was about a ceramics teacher at a community college that tried this experiment on his class. And he, at the beginning of the class, he divided the room into two groups. In one group of students, he asked them to, he told them that their grade for the class would be based on the production of pots. So they're making pots in the class. So how many they made over the course of the term. And he would just weigh the output of everything they produced, and if they made, I don't know what the number was, but let's say they made 20 pounds, that would be an A, and if they made 15 pounds, that would be a B, and so on. And the other group, he told them that their grade would be dependent on the best piece they made over the course of the entire class. So even if it was on the first week of class, they made one very good piece, that would get them an A.
So what I would think hearing that is we'd end up with the quality group having a couple masterpieces, the quantity group having a big pile of crappy pottery. That's how did it really turn out, though?
Well, that was a surprise. How it actually turned out was that the group that was the quantity group, they just got right to work, and they just, you know, every day they were experimenting, having fun, making piece after piece, you know, making lots of mistakes. But in the process, they started to get better. I mean, they learned, you know, different ways to work with the clay. They improved their technique, and they actually ended up producing the best pieces in the class. On the other hand, the quality group, because they spent so much time kind of planning out, you know, the perfect piece they were going to do, and they really invested a lot of time on each, you know, each piece they were working on, they really didn't work on that many over the length of the course, and because of that, they didn't improve. They didn't really get any better, and so their work was actually not as good as the quantity group.
So what do we learn from that? How do we apply that in our daily lives and our work lives?
Well, the lesson is that if you want to get good at something that and learn, the best way to do it is do it badly as fast as you can. You know, it just about anything you want to excel at, you need to do badly over a period of time before you learn the things that you need to learn to get better. But oftentimes the way that we approach things is we want to prepare, we want to really put a lot of effort in so we make sure we don't embarrass ourselves and make mistakes. But you know, if you look at successful people, they flip that. They look for opportunities where they can just get right out there, they can make mistakes, they can, you know, embarrass themselves, but they just learn at warp speed because they do that.
It sounds simple. It sounds kind of easy, but you used the word embarrassed there. And if I'm trying something new, especially something that other people will see the outcome of, I don't want it to be terrible. How do I overcome that fear of an embarrassing failure so I can start failing and learning?
Well, that's a big part of my whole approach. I work with people is changing their attitude towards failure. And, you know, oftentimes, you know, I work with people that are adults that have usually been successful already in their lives, and they're used to, you know, looking like experts and looking competent. And I encourage them to be willing to be a beginner at things. You know, just be a newbie. Be someone who's just out there to, like, try something, have fun. See, instead of seeing other people that as, you know, people that you want to impress, see them as teachers you can learn from. And it does take a shift in attitude, but it's really not that hard to do. It's just you just have to kind of change the way that you look at it. And it once you can start seeing things from that perspective, it allows you to just embrace a lot more opportunities and have a lot more fun doing it.
We can learn a lot from kids, it seems like, right? They haven't learned to be afraid of failing like that, have they?
Yes. Yeah, it seems like when we're born, we don't have this fear of failure. You know, kids are willing to just try anything. When they're contemplating, you know, riding a bike or investigating something or, you know, just trying something new, they don't say to themselves, oh, well, will I be good at it? You know, can I be better than Johnny? You know, they just, I'm going to go for it. I'm going to try it. And it's only as we get older, we kind of learn to, you know, we want to excel compared to others. And I don't know, I think that natural spontaneity is kind of beaten out of us in different ways. But yeah, absolutely. Kids, I know, like, my daughter's 8 years old, and definitely looking at how she approaches things really gives me an idea of the right way to go about life. Just, you know, don't worry about the consequences or whether you're going to commit to something forever or whether you're going to perform well. Just if you're curious about it and want to try it, just go for it.
Speaking of kids, do I remember there was a story about chess in your book and a kid learning to approach chess?
Well, that kid was actually me.
That was you. Okay.
Yeah, that was my somewhat embarrassing story. But when I decided to learn, before I kind of changed my perspective, I initially thought that I guess I was really stuck in the idea that I didn't want to embarrass myself or perform poorly. And there was this local chess club, and I decided the best way to learn chess would be that I would practice on my own using this computer program until I got good enough, and then I would join the local club, and I would go in, and I'd make this heroic entrance, and I would perform really well, and and then that would be the way to get into chess. And it turned out that the program that I practiced on wasn't that great a program, and when I went into the club, I was actually quickly humiliated by a better player, and I slunk away in shame. And and now I see that, gosh, that's the worst way to try to do it. My whole approach was to avoid losing games, and now if I did it, I would try to lose 100 games. If I wanted to get into chess, I'm like, how quickly can I lose 100 games of chess? Because if that's my approach, I'm going to meet all sorts of people. I'm going to have fun. I'm going to be exposed. Someone probably would have told me that the chess program I was using, the computer program, was terrible. Yeah, it would have been such a better experience. So yeah, I've completely changed the way that I think about things like that now.
And speaking of having fun, that's another one of your lessons in the book, not a little tangential to the failure, but finding the fun and making sure you have it. Why is that important?
Yeah, fun is pretty crucial. One of the reasons that fun is really critical. So fear of failure, a lot of it is just being unwilling to take chances, you know, being kind of stuck in a rut and, you know, not willing to try something else. And one of the reasons that happens is when we kind of spend too much time gritting our teeth and kind of sticking with something that we don't really enjoy, and you get kind of beaten down and you lose your enthusiasm, and then you're just afraid of trying anything, and that's just leaves you just stuck in this rut and nothing ever changes. So it's really important to find a way every day to build in some time to do something that matters to you, whatever it is, something that's meaningful to you, that you enjoy. And if you do that, and by the way, there's a lot of research studies, and we talk about these in the book, there's research studies that show that if you have more enjoyment in your life, you're more creative, you're more productive, you're more open to new possibilities. I mean, it just changes the way that you look at your life. And, I mean, so some people kind of say, like, oh, well, you know, that's a kind of a side thing. I shouldn't really worry about having fun. But really, if you don't interject some enjoyment into your life, it is very hard to change and to be in the space where you're willing to try anything new.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation now with Ryan Babineau, who says the key to success is failure. His book is called Fail Fast, Fail Often, and we want to hear from you. In your career or personal life, how have you turned failures into successes? What have you learned from your failures? Tell your stories with us, or share your stories with us on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to some callers now. We've got Havoc with us from Pewaukee. Havoc, hi.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call. This is a great topic. So, you know, I completely agree to the fact that failures will help you learn faster. But at the same time, I was wondering, you know, how practical is it to fail in a corporate environment often and still have your job?
That's a great question, Havoc. So if I'm in a job, I'm willing to fail all I want. Is my boss willing to have me fail all I want?
Well, bosses oftentimes are not so patient with people who are failing too often. But there is a way, I think the way to think about this is what you do before you fail. So if you look at successful companies, especially here in Silicon Valley, like, for example, Google is a great example, they have a way of approaching things like new projects or new services where they put the minimum investment into it. For example, they're famous for rolling out new services that they want to try. They roll them out as a beta or a testing version with, you know, they just develop it to a minimal point, and then they put it out there and they see what happens, and then if it works out, great. They can improve it. If it's, you know, a bust, oops, I'm very sorry, let me turn that.
That's all right.
I apologize for that. If it's a bust, they can move on to the next thing. So the way to think about this, I think, is to try to learn things in your corporate setting, to try projects with the minimal risk, the minimal investment. And if you find a way to, you know, take that first initial step without, you know, betting the farm on it, then when you fail, it's not a big deal. It's just a, you know, it's just an experiment. But if you make a big blunder that costs your company millions of dollars, yes, that's a big problem, and people aren't going to put up with that. So it's, you kind of need to learn the strategy, and corporations need to learn this too, to learn to take on new things with the minimal first step with the least amount of risk.
What's your chapter title? Think Big, Act Small, I think it was?
Yes, yeah.
We'll go back to the phones. Thanks for that. Thanks for bringing that up, Havoc. We've got Michael with us in Greenfield. Michael, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I love the show, and I'm going to have to get this book. I completely agree with what you guys are saying. I actually accidentally did this experiment last year. I'm in a band, and we came out with two albums. And the first one we took a couple years to make, and it was really good. You know, it had a lot of thought to it, but didn't really have that well of a reception. And then our second one we made a couple months to make, and just kind of going along the same things, but made it real quick, and it was way better. I mean, I completely agree with it, what you're saying.
All right. Well, Michael, thanks a lot for sharing that. You know, it makes me think, too, with modern technology, say music recording, Ryan, instead of it being a long, elaborate process to burn vinyl albums, a band can pop a song all night the day they record it in practice, maybe get some feedback, hey, that song was terrible, here's what we need to change. They can fail often and keep refining their music in a way that wouldn't have been possible back in the old days.
Absolutely. That's a great example. Today, the technology and the tools that we have to create media and then just immediately post it and get feedback create opportunities to, as you're saying, fail, you know, right away. Or just get, I mean, it's not necessarily failure. It's just getting your stuff out there and getting immediate feedback. And because you can do it that day, it means it encourages you to not spend, you know, 5-6 months overworking something when you could just make something that day, get some feedback, and then improve it the next day.
One of the obstacles to this mindset that you talk about, this willingness to embrace failure, is an idea that a lot of us have a not-yet view of life. We're going to do this awesome thing someday, when the stars are right, when we're financially secure, when the economy's better, et cetera. How do we shake ourselves out of that?
Well, that's kind of the main thing I do as a career counselor, is try to change people's perspectives. It's hard to know exactly where it comes from, but as adults, we get very good at talking ourselves out of taking action. There's always some reason why, you know, we're not prepared enough, the time's not right, we need to focus on something else, or maybe we feel too stressed right now. It's so easy to come up with excuses not to do things, and you know, it's really, you can flip that. There's always something you can do this week that will be something new. It's something you want to explore. It's something you're curious about. And it's really important to change that mindset from always talking yourself out of living the life you deserve to just being willing to find, well, what's that little step? It doesn't matter how small it is, but what's something I can do that'll get me out there to try something new?
Go back to our callers now. We've got Mark with us in Kenosha. Mark, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
Well, years ago in the newspaper business, when we first started using desktop publishing techniques, somebody said to me, faster computer and it really must allow you to get your work done sooner, as though the objective was meeting the deadline. And I said, you know, and this was, my gosh, this was the early 90s, late 80s. I said, no. I said, what it allows me to do is to try more possibilities in the same amount of time and improve what I'm doing. And what I learned from that experience, I have applied pretty much to my entire life. I will come home at night and people say, what are you going to do? And I'm going to say, well, I'm going to do some wiring in the basement, or I'm going to throw a diesel engine in my pickup truck. And they say, you know how to do that? And I said, no, but how hard could it be?
Not yet.
You know?
All right, yeah. Mark, thanks a lot for sharing that. And that story about desktop publishing, I have the same story, but going from digital audio to, or from audio tape to digital editing. It was never faster. You just did it 8 different ways where you used to do it in one way. What do you think of Mark's story, Ryan?
I really like that example. I mean, the idea of using technology to try more things in the same amount of time, that's a really nice way to think about things. And that is, you know, that is an opportunity in so many fields. We have, you know, that's something that's possible in many more fields these days that wasn't available in the past.
In our last couple minutes, I think there are probably people out there saying, okay, this sounds nice. I don't know where to start. I don't know what I don't know what I want to do and fail at. Can you give us a few guidelines to get started? And let's use the words this week or maybe this weekend.
Sure. Well, one thing you can do is you can find, you know, most of us have this list of things like the things we want to do someday or try someday. I want to try yoga or hang gliding, or I want to learn Arabic, or, you know, travel to someplace. Well, one thing is to take this to-do list that's usually, you know, one day, a year, 2, 5 years, and make it a kind of this week list. Take those things and find something, you know, just pick one of those and find something, a little step you can do this week. So, you know, go to a, you know, sign up for a class, or go to a, you know, go to a language class, or just, I guess it depends on what you're doing, but find some specific step. I mean, that's one way you can do it. Some other things I suggested before were to think of, be a beginner, be willing to go out there and make mistakes, and also learn to unplan things. So instead of when there's something you're curious about trying, instead of making a big, huge production out of it and thinking about it long-term and how you need to commit to it, just try to find the smallest step you can immediately take. And usually there's something you can there's just about always something you can do in the next week or two, and that's all you need to worry about. You don't have to worry about the next month or year or 5 years. Just find the thing that you can do right away.
Ryan, what are you failing at lately, or what are you preparing to fail at in the near future?
Well, let's see. I'm starting a new business, which I think I guess that will be an opportunity to fail. Gosh, it seems like I'm so good at I'm always failing at things. I actually enjoy it. What are some other things? It's funny. You're kind of
caught you off guard there.
Yeah, you caught me. You caught me off guard. I mean, it's such a kind of main focus for me. I don't always think about it. It's just like, well, what am I exploring? What am I trying? You know, one thing I'm going to try as an adult just coming up is downhill skiing.
Oh,
which
there's
I'm
a
looking forward to, like, you know, just going and taking my daughter with me. And we've already, you know, talked about how we're going to fall and, you know, just make fools of ourselves and have a great time doing it.
That's what I did last year with my daughters. It was very embarrassing, but it was a lot of fun. Ryan, thanks so much for being with us today.
Rob, thank you so much for having me.
That was Ryan Babineau. He's a career counselor. He's the co-author of the book Fail Fast, Fail Often, How Losing Can Help You Win. It's time for our weekly check-in on the top news here in Wisconsin. WPR News Director Michael Leland joins us. Michael, welcome to the show.
Thanks a lot. Happy 4th.
Well, we've got happy holidays to you, too.
Well, thanks.
Before I continue. The Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court now, has been up to a lot in the last couple of weeks. Hobby Lobbies and high-tech rulings, search and seizure, all that. There's one ruling, I think it was last week, but it has an echo in Wisconsin this week, the buffer zone.
Right,
so what's going on?
The buffer zone. Last week, the U.S. Supreme Court passed this law that basically struck down a 35-foot buffer zone that Massachusetts had created around people attending, you know, going to abortion clinics and women's clinics. The court majority said that that law violated First Amendment rights. So this week in Madison, the city said it would stop enforcing a law that created a buffer zone in Madison around healthcare facilities. That law was designed to protect patients and staff from protesters, especially outside the Planned Parenthood clinic, which is the sole abortion provider in Madison.
And how did Madison's buffer zone law compare to what was just struck down in Massachusetts?
A little bit different. In Madison, the ordinance creates a 100-foot buffer zone around healthcare facilities. And then if you imagine within that zone, I mean, you can go into that zone without any problem, but within that zone, a protester, for example, could not approach within 8 feet of another person to either speak to them or hand them pamphlets or whatever without their permission. So at first, Madison officials said, well, our zone is not the same as Massachusetts, so this doesn't really apply to us. But then this week, the city attorney said the ruling does raise significant concerns about how valid Madison's buffer zone is.
I think Gilman Halstead, our reporter, mentioned that some people call the Madison version a bubble zone because it creates a bubble around individuals within this wider zone.
Exactly. Once you're in that zone, they imagine this 8-foot bubble around you and no one can come inside that bubble without your permission.
So the city is what, going to completely stop enforcing this, or are they kind of picking and choosing what sticks around?
It'll be part. They will not enforce parts of the ordinance that a state established that sort of bubble zone, buffer zone, but it will continue enforcing parts of the ordinance that prevent people from physically blocking others from entering a facility.
And what's ahead? I assume this is something that local government, in this case, would revisit and try to maybe continue part or all of the law, but more in compliance with what seems to be coming from the Supreme Court.
Of course, the alder who supports this law, the lead supporter of this, says that they will work with the city attorney to see if there are ways of changing the current law to make it fit the Supreme Court's ruling rather than just flat-out repealing it. But, of course, the law has its critics as well, and a group called Alliance Defending Freedom has been challenging Madison's law, and it says the city should just go ahead and repeal it now.
Okay, so this is something conceivably that could move up through the courts in its current form or whatever the city goes on to do in the future.
This will not be the last of it, for sure.
All right. And then a new test run for food share in Wisconsin. This is one I'm not as familiar with. What's going on there?
So as of this past Tuesday, July 1st, people who live in Racine, Kenosha, and Walworth counties who receive food share, that's food stamps, mm-hmm. Will have to be working or going to school to continue getting that benefit. These three counties are test sites this year for Wisconsin. The new requirements will go statewide next year. The Department of Health Services in Wisconsin says it chose these counties because they say the counties are a good representation of the state. They're a good mix of rural and urban areas and have a moderate caseload level.
And where's this change coming from? A change in state requirements or the feds or who's behind
this
that
change? This is actually several years old. The change was mandated by the federal government several years ago, but the state has gotten a waiver for the past few years. But then this past year, they were included in Governor Walker's budget. And again, starting with these three counties now, then in January going statewide.
And is this every single person currently receiving food stamps, food share, or just a part of the population?
Yeah, a lot of people, but not everyone. The requirement affects adults between the ages of 18 and 49 who have no minor children living with them and who are able to work. So that amounts to about 5,000 people during this pilot phase for the rest of the year. Mm-hmm. And it expands to about 60,000 people as of January.
And what's been the reaction since the federal government imposed these guidelines and now that the state is catching up with them?
Yeah, anti-hunger advocates are among the critics. The head of Hunger Task Force in Milwaukee says this program will face a big test in January when it expands into Milwaukee. They're predicting that it's going to be challenging for groups like theirs, as well as food pantries and homeless shelters, as the demand for those services could go up as possibly tens of thousands, as we mentioned, as many as 60,000 people statewide could lose their food stamp benefits. Now, some of them obviously will choose to either, go to school or find some work to protect their benefits. And the state's Department of Workforce Development says it'll work with them. But inevitably, there will be some people who will lose their food stamp benefits next year.
And is the Department of Workforce Development going to try to connect people with jobs where possible with educational opportunities where jobs aren't available?
I think especially on the jobs end, they will try to look mm-hmm. for some kind of employment. And there may be other ways to get people into, technical schools or community college or something like that. Again, just to see what options might be available. And some people will pursue those avenues. Some will find it difficult, and some may just flat out choose not to.
Hmm. Well, interesting. I'm sure we'll be following that as the test program comes in, and then the full state comes in next
January,
year, you said?
In January, yeah.
Okay. Well, we had some rough weather this week. There was one day here in Vilas Hall where we were thinking, are we going to need to, run a reel of tape and go to the basement or something? This was a big deal. I keep seeing press releases from the governor over this last couple of weeks. Governor Tour's latest storm day. Damage.
Yeah, he was on the storm damage tour this week. We had really, if you think about it, three rounds of severe weather across the southern part of the state. If you start on Saturday night and going through Tuesday night, Saturday night, people in the La Crosse area will remember you had thunderstorms and strong winds knocking out power to a lot of people and damaging buildings and trees. The governor toured that area earlier this week. And then, of course, Sunday night, it got worse. The National Weather Service says there were three tornadoes in Iowa and Dane counties. The ones in Iowa County were classified as what's called EF2, which generally is winds between 100 and 135 miles an hour. Those were both just a few miles north of Dodgeville, and they damaged some homes and farm buildings. And then later that evening, there was an EF1 twister. That's a little bit milder, but still a storm you don't want to be outside in. That's about 85 to 110 miles an hour winds. And that hit just outside of the town of Oregon in Dane County, and it damaged a number of trees and some farm fields.
And just when we started thinking, glad that weekend's done in the state, we got more.
Right. There was Monday afternoon and evening, and this is what you were just mentioning. This hit late in the afternoon. More severe weather, thunderstorms, high winds, 60 to 70 miles an hour in some places. A lot of reports of trees down, farm fields, crops damaged. There were tornado warnings. No actual tornadoes touched down on Monday that the Weather Service was able to confirm. A lot of people lost power, though. More than 130,000 customers lost power at some point in that storm. And in southeast Wisconsin, some of the customers of We Energies were just getting their power restored Wednesday evening, so nearly 2 days after the storm hit. Some of the tougher to restore homes were still still in the process of getting their power back.
A rough week, but as they say, it could have been worse.
It could have been worse. Yeah, there were no injuries that were reported. Certainly no deaths. And, there was damage to buildings, but, there were no, homes completely destroyed or anything like that. But, a scary few days of weather. But you're right.
Knock on wood.
Exactly.
Well, let's look ahead to after the holiday weekend. We've talked to Senator Ron Johnson about his ongoing legal challenge to part of the Affordable Care Act. And there's some news coming up on that.
Right. This is a lawsuit he filed back in January is going to get a hearing on Monday morning in Green Bay. A judge is going to determine whether Senator Johnson will have any legal standing to sue the federal government over part of the Affordable Care Act. Now, a little bit of backstory here. Back in January, the senator challenged part of the Affordable Care Act that allows the federal government to pay about 70% of the health care premiums for members of Congress and their staffs. Now, that's the same arrangement that's already in place for most federal government workers. But the senator says it's unfair to taxpayers in general because most members of Congress and people who work for them earn too much money to otherwise qualify for subsidies under the new Affordable Care Act.
And this is a legal challenge. What's been some of the political reaction to Senator Johnson's suit since he first filed it?
Well, a number of senators, a few dozen, have signed a legal brief supporting it, but not everybody thinks it's a great idea. Congressman James Sensenbrenner in Wisconsin back in January call this an unfortunate political stunt.
This is a fellow Republican.
Exactly. He said it's common for employers to help pay for health care coverage and that if the subsidy stopped, it could actually hurt Congress. He says it could cause some longtime congressional staffers to leave to look for other jobs, and that could hurt a lot of the institutional knowledge and the work that gets done in congressional offices.
Now, Senator Johnson is generally opposed to the Affordable Care Act. He makes no secret
exactly
of that.
Right.
This particular challenge, it doesn't sound like it's something that's going to blow the whole thing up. It's just a
probably not. It's just picking away at this one part of it that he has particular problems with. Legal scholars are saying it's a long shot that he'll be given standing to sue the government. They're saying that he has to prove that he's been personally harmed by the administration's actions. He says he has. It'll be up to the judge to decide, where he's going to come down on that.
You've got fronts coming in from the executive, the legislative, and the judicial. You get some interesting political tornadoes coming out of those.
Exactly. Nice weather metaphor, Jim.
Thank you. Well, have a good holiday weekend, Michael.
Thanks, you too.
That was WPR News Director Michael Leland. We check in on the top ongoing stories in Wisconsin every Friday at this time, even on holidays. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.